Today is Thursday, February 25th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden reviews U.S. global supply chain.
President Joe Biden wants to address through an executive order for a 100-day government review of global supply chains.
Also, dozens killed in Ecuador's prison riots.
The government says police officers were wounded but gave no details, and prison officials managed to get out during the riots.
Plus, EU leaders begin a two-day virtual summit. These stories and more are next. President Joe Biden signed an executive order on Wednesday for a government review of global supply chains and potential U.S. vulnerabilities in key industries, including computer chips, electric vehicle batteries, pharmaceuticals, and critical minerals used in electronics. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this story.
Before ramping up production following the early months of the pandemic, the U.S. had a national shortage of personal protective equipment such as masks and gloves. Now, American automakers struggle to find semiconductor chips to keep assembly lines moving. These are among the issues President Joe Biden wants to address through an executive order for a 100-day government review of global supply chains and potential U.S. vulnerabilities in key industries, including electric vehicle batteries, semiconductors, critical minerals used in electronics, and pharmaceuticals.
These reviews will identify policy recommendations to 40 of our supply chain, to fortify our supply chains at every step, and critically to start implementing those recommendations right away.
Biden's order will also direct year-long reviews in the defense sector, public health, transportation, energy, information technology, and food production. The review can help U.S. companies invest strategically and become more agile during a crisis, said Scott Miller, a senior advisor on the global economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The key is, particularly with dramatic change or rapid change, you've got to do a good job of forecasting, and you got to think holistically. You got to look at the entire sort of life cycle of the operation.
While the executive order does not mention any country, the U.S. is particularly dependent on China in many critical industries and for rare earth minerals needed to make everything from consumer electronics to military equipment. Neda Sanders is a professor of supply chain management at Northeastern University.
That is not a good spot to be in. Having said that, I think to just say we're just focused on China is really short-sighted. And I think that this policy really looks at a really broad picture in terms of U.S. production, manufacture, economy. So it's not just China.
The Trump administration also pushed to shore up supply chains, mostly through tax cuts, to encourage American firms to manufacture domestically and import tariffs. Biden's strategy is different, says Samira Fazil, deputy director of the White House National Economic Council.
This work is not going to be about America going it alone. The answer to these weaknesses is not always to be to ramp up domestic production.
These little chips here.
On Wednesday, Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris also met with lawmakers at the White House in order to garner bipartisan support to ensure supply chain resiliency. Patsy Widas-Kuwara, VOA News.
U.S. technology companies with millions of users worldwide face renewed scrutiny and stepped up efforts to regulate them in Washington. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
In the wake of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, there is renewed interest in looking at the power of technology giants. Protesters reportedly used social media to plan. Facebook and Twitter kicked off their sites. Former President Donald Trump and others, Google, Apple, and Amazon, booted Parler, an app used by supporters of Trump. Jerry Davis is a professor of management at the University of Michigan.
The real source of power is being an intermediary that everyone has to pass through. That's really the thing that we want to look at.
Scrutinizing so-called big tech is nothing new. Google, Facebook, and Amazon are already facing antitrust investigations, and tech CEOs routinely testify in Congress. While many agree that tech has too much power, they differ on what to do about it. Break up the companies? Restrict their abilities to collect user data and allow users to sue if their privacy is violated. put laws in place to make the firms responsible if they are conduits for online falsehoods? India McKinney is the Director of Federal Affairs at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The Republicans are upset at what they see is cancel culture or companies moderating conservative speech on their platforms. And Democrats tend to be more concerned that platforms aren't moderating enough and are leaving up too much hate speech or too much harassment.
When it comes to online misinformation, something both parties say is a problem, creating new rules can be difficult, particularly in the U.S., where the First Amendment protects speech. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
European Union leaders will talk vaccines, borders, and COVID passports during a two-day video conference starting Thursday that will address security and defense issues. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports the talks are shadowed by growing criticism of EU's slow coronavirus vaccine rollout.
Critics of the European Union's COVID vaccine strategy got new ammunition this week. A new German study suggests that while the United States and ex-EU member Britain may achieve herd immunity by year's end, thanks to their relatively rapid vaccine rollouts, key EU countries like France, Germany, and Italy will have to triple their daily vaccinations to get there. The dissent has come within EU ranks, starting with Hungary's leader, Viktor Orban, who has turned instead to Russian and now Chinese vaccines as alternatives. All this is backdropping the EU's two-day virtual summit. Brussels-based analyst Camino Montero Martinez from the Center for European Reform think tank says leaders attending it also face mounting backlash at home.
I think that's going to hit citizens quite sharply. Spring and the summer rolls over and they realize they will spend a second year without Easter holidays, without potentially being able to travel outside of the country for summer. And I think this is playing in European governments.
The European Commission, the EU's executive arm tasked for procuring the vaccines, has borne the brunt of criticism over production shortfalls and other problems. Chief Ursula von der Leyen acknowledged mistakes, but she recently told a German newspaper the 27-member bloc is now catching up to Britain. And analyst Mortera Martinez believes most EU leaders will close ranks in a public show of support for the commission. They're also expected to discuss international efforts to supply vaccines to developing countries, along with so-called vaccination certificates to ensure safe travel, but which are controversial. So are border restrictions by some EU states aimed to slow the virus's spread? Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
At least 79 people have died in simultaneous violent riots in four Ecuadorian prisons, which the government described as a concerted action by criminal organizations. Gillian Kitchener of Reuters reports.
Scores of people have been killed in simultaneous riots that erupted at four Ecuadorian prisons on Tuesday. The government is blaming gang violence and believes it was a concerted action. Relatives outside were desperate for news. We just want a list, he says. I just want to know if my brother is all right. The government says police officers were wounded but gave no details, and prison officials managed to get out during the riots. The prisons involved hold about 70% of Ecuador's prison population, according to official statistics. President Lenin Moreno has tried to control prison violence in Ecuador, declaring a temporary state of emergency for the prison system because of the frequent gang fighting.
That's Gillian Kitchener of Reuters. The shadowy violent Islamist insurgency in Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado region has confounded authorities, residents, aid groups, and observers. The pandemic has only made this region less accessible. VOA's Anita Powell talks to analysts familiar with the region and brings us this report.
By any account, Mozambique's northern region is in bad shape. The United Nations estimates that 1.3 million people urgently need humanitarian assistance in the area. In 2020, nearly 580,000 people were forced to flee their homes amid violence that saw insurgents killing high-ranking members of the National Security Forces. The violence has destroyed livelihoods, disrupted markets, and driven up prices of essential goods. Cholera is on the rise, and the violence has destroyed more than a third of the area's health facilities. So how did we get here? Carlton Cariado, a security researcher at Maputo's Joaquim Chissano University, says the first mistake back in 2017 was the government's.
The government underestimated the threat. And this underestimation of the threat was also associated with the lack of knowledge of what was going on the ground. The government did not have the logistic and the capacity to deal with the problem. That's why I cannot hesitate to say that there was a failure in dealing with the problem in the first instance.
Which, says journalist Tom Bowker, is a surprising oversight. Bowker, founder and editor of Mozambique-focused website Zitamar News, was expelled from Mozambique last week and banned for 10 years. It's partly, he thinks, because of his paper's reporting on the conflict in this gas-rich region, where seasonal hunger and poverty are rife. But, he said, the region has always been problematic. The only change is that now the world knows about it.
Life out there has always been hard, and I think that's been a fertile province for an insurgency to happen. It does have an Islamist element to it, but it's definitely fueled by the fact that people are dissatisfied with the hand they've got in life and with, I suppose, with the trajectory of Mozambique and Cabo Delgado since independence as well, when things have not worked out as people would have hoped. And the advent of the LNG project in the province as well is only going to add to that feeling of inequality and people missing out on riches.
Alex Fiennes, director of the Africa program at Chatham House, says there's no one cause of this conflict, which makes it harder to solve.
So organized crime, poor governance, inequality, all of these things play in, as well as core periphery politics. And so there are echoes with what we're seeing in the Sahel and other places of poor periphery politics. Having said that, the big difference, and the one that I still struggle with, that the president and some of the elite around him come from Cabo Delgado. This is their backyard. So that's different from Kidal in Mali and some of the other places that we're talking about that would be peripheries.
Jasmine Opperman, Africa analyst at Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, says the lack of knowledge is a major problem.
But actually no one can state to know what is happening in Cabo Delgado as a hardcore fact, that we do not simply know what is going to happen. And we can come up with scenarios and we can come up with hypotheses, but what is clear is that the insurgents have gained a lot of advantage.
Opperman said that it's encouraging that Mozambique's military has stepped in, taking much of the security burden off local police, but adds that this conflict will take time to resolve. How much time? Again, as with many things in Mozambique's northern region, no one can say for sure. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America. Hundreds of German police officers conducted coordinated raids in Berlin and the surrounding states of Brandenburg in investigation of an organization banned over allegations of Islamic extremism. The state interior ministry said 850 police, including SWAT teams, were involved in the early Thursday raids on apartments linked to members of the organization known as Jamaatu Berlin. Members of a group supporting Myanmar's military junta have attacked and injured people protesting against the army's February 1st seizure of power that ousted the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. The chaos complicates an already intractable standoff between the military and a protest movement that has been staging daily large-scale demonstrations. You are listening to International Edition and the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Pope Francis' planned visit to Iraq from March 5th to March 8th is complex on many levels. COVID-19 cases are rising, as are terrorist incidents in recent weeks. The historic but greatly diminished Christian community says it needs a boost. However, from the Catholic leader, after 3 years of devastation carried out by militants of Islamic State group and the pontiff, also wants to reach out to the Muslim world by meeting with a highly revered Shiite cleric. Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Pope Francis's visit to Iraq marks his first foreign trip after a 15-month gap due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's also the first ever papal visit to this biblical land. For years, the Pope expressed his concerns publicly for the plight of Iraq's Christians and its many religious minorities, including the Yazidis, who both have suffered at the hands of Islamic State militants and sectarian violence. The Reverend Emmanuel Yohana, an Iraqi priest in the Assyrian Church of the East, told VOA that Christians, now only numbering between 150,000 and 400,000, down from 1.5 million in 2003, are greatly encouraged by the Pope's visit. Iraqi authorities are responsible for his safety.
The Christians are very much optimistic because it's a sign of hope, sign of solidarity, especially it is coming despite the pandemic, despite the security challenge. So it's a strong sign of solidarity. There are security challenges, it's quite clear. We pray, we hope there will be nothing.
Father Yohana runs the Christian Aid Program Northern Iraq, which assists displaced Iraqis, including Yazidis around Duhok in the north and the Nineveh Plain, where tens of thousands were forcibly displaced by Islamic State militants from 2014 until 2017. He says that less than half of the original inhabitants of the Nineveh Plain, the historic Christian heartland of Iraq, have returned. Some families remain displaced in the northern Kurdish region or have fled abroad, he says, while others fear the Shiite militias that have confiscated their properties. The Pope will visit Mosul, badly destroyed by Islamic State militants, where rebuilding efforts are now underway at the city's iconic El Nouri Mosque and Our Lady of the Hour Church. French Dominican Reverend Olivier Poquillon is helping to oversee the work. He praised the effort where Muslims, Christians, and other communities work together to do something positive together.
We know that it will be a challenge for everybody to rebuild trust among persons, families, communities. This is our faith. We believe in a God of mercy, and we've got this humanity as a common responsibility.
Pope Francis will also meet one of Shiite Islam's most authoritative figures, the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, as part of his efforts to embrace all of the Islamic world. The pontiff will also participate in an interreligious meeting in the southern town of Ur, birthplace of the Old Testament patriarch Abraham, recognized as a father of faith in one God by Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike. Gil Gaflak for VOA News, Amman.
A UN human rights expert is calling for an urgent investigation into allegations that Eritrean forces have forcibly repatriated Eritrean refugees who were living in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province. His report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council, and Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdel Salam Babiker, started his mandate on November 1st. An Ethiopian military offensive began in Tigray November 4th, after months of rising tensions between Addis Ababa and forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. When the conflict erupted, he says more than 96,000 Eritrean refugees were in four camps. Addressing the Human Rights Council on Wednesday, Babiker said he has received information from credible sources about the precarious situation of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the province. Babiker added,
I'm also concerned about the allegations of possible implication of the Eritrean troops in cases of serious human rights violations, including acts of abductions, forceful or involuntary return of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers, and their imprisonment in different prisons inside Eritrea. Such allegations need to be investigated promptly and thoroughly by independent mechanisms.
There was no response from the Ethiopian or Eritrean governments. Babiker said he is particularly concerned about two refugee camps in Tigray that hosted more than 25,000 Eritreans. These, he said, allegedly were destroyed in attacks by Eritrean and Ethiopian troops. Acts which would constitute a serious breach of international humanitarian law.
On the 20th of January 2021, in my letter to the government of Ethiopia, I called on the Ethiopian authorities to protect the human rights of the Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the Tigray region and to ensure respect for their rights under human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international refugee law.
Babakir said he wants Eritrean authorities to give him full access to refugees and asylum seekers allegedly in Eritrean prisons. Babakir also said he has received no response to previous requests from the Eritrean authorities to visit Eritrea to assess the human rights situation on the ground. Eritrean Ambassador at Large Tesfamikael Geratu dismissed the special rapporteur's report as being full of senseless allegations and of presenting a bleak, unjustified picture of his country. He said his government has succeeded in creating meaningful, sustainable development based on social justice. He added it was time for the Council to end its harassment of Eritrea and terminate its mandate on the human rights situation in the country, which has been going on for 8 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Officials in Nigeria's Borno state say 10 people have died from explosions around the northeast city of Maiduguri. Residents in affected areas have fled their homes. Local officials suspect Islamist militant group Boko Haram was behind the blasts, as Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
There was relative calm on Wednesday, and residents who fled their homes last night returned to the affected areas of Adamkolo, Wangi, and Kaleri. The Borno State Governor, Babagana Zulum, visited two hospitals in the morning and confirmed in a statement that 10 people were killed in the attack, including children who were playing in a field. He said 47 others were injured. No one has claimed responsibility, but Maiduguri resident Sani Adam blamed the blasts on the group Boko Haram.
The death was as a result of projectiles fired by the Boko Haram from the outskirts, which landed in three different locations.
Maiduguri is the capital of Borno State, the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency. For years, the group has carried out bloody raids and suicide bombings here. The last one until Wednesday occurred 1 year ago. Governor Zulum said authorities are taking measures after the explosions. He said the military has repelled the insurgents. But Maiduguri resident Andy Rufai said he heard multiple explosions and was terrified.
When I came back from work, I started hearing the explosion, which is close to my area. And later, there was gunshot and a multiple of the bomb blast, more than 10.
The Borno State Health Ministry says it is taking care of all the injured people. An estimated 36,000 people have been killed since the Boko Haram insurgency started in 2009. Boko Haram has been fighting to create an Islamic State based in Nigeria. Timothy Ubiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Residents of Nigeria's northern city of Maiduguri say they still feel unsafe despite recent successes by the military against the Boko Haram terror group. The government on Tuesday announced the recapture of the strategic town of Mate in Borno State after weeks under control of the insurgents. For more on this security situation, I spoke with public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed.
What I think more needs to be done, because some people in the society are still sympathetic to them. They're giving them cover, providing logistics, and so on and so forth. The terrorists are still around. The people in the society provide cover to the terrorists, just like how fish needs water to survive.
Has life returned to normal, as you know it, in Maiduguri and environs?
Well, for Maiduguri and Jere and with some of the local government, I believe people are doing well and okay. But to be honest, in some parts of the state, like Demaset, Baga, people are still trying to acclimatize. It's a traumatic experience, and people are still antsy. People don't even know which way to go about.
Can you confirm that some people are fleeing from their villages into neighboring countries just to escape the onslaught of the Boko Haram terrorists?
At the moment, I don't think people are fleeing. Rather, I would say people are returning back from Niger, from Cameroon. There is no anywhere where I've heard that people are still running to, you know, neighboring countries like Niger and Chad and Cameroon. Initially, it happened last 2-3 years, but now they are coming back. Late last year, November, December, we have been seeing refugees in Cameroon and they're returning back to Nigeria.
That's public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed speaking with me from Maiduguri. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.